Thank you for tuning in to this special episode of Movie Geeks United. We've combed through our archives to bring you what we believe represents the very best our show has to offer. Tonight, we bring you three extraordinary talents. James Cameron, who appeared on our show to promote the re-release of Avatar. Abel Ferrara, of Bad Lieutenant and King of New York fame, who chatted with us about one of his latest independent projects, Last Day on Earth, starring Willem Dafoe, and legendary independent writer-director John Sayles, who joined us for a wide-ranging conversation about many of the great works that populate his astounding career, including his film Honey Dripper, starring Danny Glover. We begin with James Cameron. Avatar re-release this Friday, August 27th, I believe in something like 750 IMAX screens. Could be your last opportunity to see the film in IMAX and in 3D and the way it's meant to be seen and on a big screen. So we spoke to James Cameron earlier in the week about the re-release and some other aspects of his career. And here he is. Enjoy it, everybody.
You're in there. You're here. How much have you logged?
Zip. I read a manual.
Tell me you're joking.
Go. Don't. Got this.
So you just figured you'd come out here to the most hostile environment known to man, with no training of any kind, and see how it went? What was going through your head?
Maybe I'll see the doctor telling me what I couldn't do.
Metrics are good.
23 is ready.
Your arms in, hands in, head down. Down. Just relax and let your mind go blank. It shouldn't be hard for you.
It's the darkest part of the universe.
Initiate lights.
Jamie, this is Jim.
Hi, Mr. Cameron. How are you, sir?
Fest? Are we going to have a geek fest here?
That's what we're all about. My co-host Jerry is on the line with us, too.
Oh, hey, Jerry. Hi.
I'm fine. It's very nice to meet you, Mr. Cameron.
Good. Nice to do.
We're very excited about this re-release. And you know, I remember reading kind of your disappointment in the first quarter of the year when you knew that Avatar had to leave some of these 3D screens to make room for the other product, the Clash of the Titans and Alice.
I think it would be pretty crazy to say that we were disappointed with any of the release of Avatar. But I think what we saw was a reality that the number of screens, was limiting. That it was a very finite ecosystem. It was big enough, and we're grateful that it was big enough to support one big movie. Because if you really think about it, there was a period of time where it was debatable whether you could even have a big hit movie in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we got past that hurdle, but we didn't get past the second hurdle, which is how do you do two big hit movies at the same time in the marketplace? And that it wasn't possible. It's possible now because we've about doubled the number of 3D screens internationally and domestically as well, just in the last, 6 months, which is awesome. It means it's all
mm-hmm.
happening, and it's happening, at an accelerating rate. But what happened was we lost all of our IMAX screens, most of which were selling out on one day. We went to zero, and
wow.
That was when Alice in Wonderland came out. So pretty much the next day, I was talking to the IMAX guy saying, "All right, what's your next opening? What's your next lull in the action that we can come back in?" I mean,
mm-hmm.
I was thinking about it right away.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you've kind of become the official spokesperson and advocate for 3D now.
Right, 3D.
Right, the native 3D,
exactly.
which I think more and more filmmakers are getting on board with. I know
yeah.
Scorsese's doing his 3D
yeah.
film,
yeah.
Which that's an exciting prospect right there. But
yep.
have filmmakers approached you and questioned you about the technology
sure.
since Avatar?
Sure, absolutely. I've done a few tutorials and I've done a few phone calls, and I've run out to the camera shop and talked them through it. The thing I tell any director that wants to get into 3D is just get the camera. And just go
mm-hmm.
shoot some stuff for a couple of days, do some tests, learn about stereo space and what you can do and have fun with it, because instead of fearing it and feeling that you know, it's just a limitation, they should start to think about, all right, how can I create my own style in 3D? How can I make this a new set of colors to paint with, you know? And the problem is that there are actually people who are like professional 3D experts, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with these people is when they get on a set with a director and a DP who are new in 3D, what does the stereo guru do? They interpose themselves all the time and talk about all the things you can't do, as opposed to what they should do, which is stand back and say, you all just carry on doing what you're doing. It'll be great. Because that's the answer. That's the truth. It's like it shouldn't affect your style that much.
Right.
You know, the 3D should always be value added. It shouldn't. It should never be a limitation.
Mm-hmm. But you've always been so unique in that with each project, it seems like you set out to do the impossible. You set out to show people something they've never seen before. And at the same time, you latch on to very familiar kind of universal themes,
right,
that appeal to the masses. So with Avatar, what were those universal themes that you wanted to explore? And did people latch on to the aspects of the story that you were expecting them to?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, there's not too many movie releases that are kind of like a perfect laboratory experiment, but this was one, because you don't do a film that's the highest grossing film of all time across all cultures and markets if it's not firing on all cylinders. So that mm-hmm. way, you know, you don't have to dismiss part of it as you know, having not worked. Mm-hmm. So we know that the action, the visual, all that stuff worked. But we also know kind of pretty definitively that the spirituality, that the environmental themes, mm-hmm. you know, the hippie tree hugger stuff that the studio tried to get me to take out, that worked as well. Maybe not for everybody, but for enough of a majority of the viewers that it vindicated itself.
I'm not looking her eyes. Is there? Down, down, Susie. The crown is not horse. Once a halo is made, the crown will fly with only one hunter in the whole life. To become Aronio, hunter, you must choose your own Ikran, and he must choose you.
When?
When you are ready.
I think if you look, you know, historically at big Hollywood movies, I'm not talking about small films or documentaries, I'm talking about like big tentpole movies, there certainly haven't been any that I can think of that are environmentally themed or have that kind of conscience.
No, absolutely.
Them. You know, I mean, yeah. You could say maybe Day After Tomorrow, but that, you know, the science on that was so bad that it kind of was a setback.
Well, Jerry actually had a question about another aspect of the content.
Yeah,
so.
I think, first of all, my hat's off to you just for making, first of all, the biggest film and ballsiest film about American imperialism I've ever seen.
Well, thank you. Yes, that's there as well.
You know, a lot of directors over the past couple of years, the last decade, have tried to make these films that deal with the themes that you were dealing with, and they fell on their faces. They couldn't do it. They're too preachy or whatever, but here you bring up, we were talking to some documentary filmmakers a couple months ago, and I just said that Avatar was probably the biggest cinematic indictment of U.S. imperialism I've ever seen, and does it so well.
You know, I mean, when I was writing the film, I mean, we had, you know, I was writing the film in early 05, and, you know, I mean, I'd written the treatment way back earlier,
mm-hmm.
and the story didn't change that much from the treatment, but I think some of the influences were, you know, the fact that we were at the peak of the fighting in the Iraq War. We'd gone in 2 years earlier, but you know, the peak of the prolonged sort of combat period.
Right.
And you know, I was just reacting to the fact that I was infuriated by the fact by us going into Iraq in the first place. There was certainly plenty of literature and plenty of information around that you know, that there were no WMD before we went in, and that the whole thing was a you know, a big pack of lies, which it ultimately proved to be. And you know, I was kind of infuriated by that, and so it sort of leaked into the writing. But it's also, you know, I mean, by extrapolation, it's also about the entire, you know, kind of colonial period and this kind of, you know, the whole manifest destiny period of America 150 years ago, where we were just sort of busy, you know, like a juggernaut expanding west and taking everything from the indigenous. And that's going on right now in Brazil, the same issues. You know, Avatar is happening for real right now in Brazil with these, you know, big hydroelectric dam projects that are displacing literally tens of thousands of indigenous people from their tribal lands, and they're fighting back. And you know, I mean, there was just a situation that happened a couple of weeks ago where 300 Indians from a number of different tribes, you know, came out of the rainforest and took 150 construction workers hostage at a dam project, and it was not very far away from where I had just been. When I say not very far, by Brazilian standards, it was a couple hundred miles away. But I'm sure some of the same, indigenous people that I had met with there were involved in this other action. You know, these people are fighting for their lives and their way of life right now. So it goes back deep into history, way before Iraq, and it's going to carry on, I think, for some time, at least until we're all one kind of homogenized society wearing blue jeans and eating McDonald's.
What always interested me about this stage in your career, you've made the two highest-grossing movies of all time, and you're as successful, and you've made as much of a mark on the history of the medium as any director in history. So once you've reached that pinnacle, how do you access where you have yet to grow as an artist?
Well, I think you grow as an artist on every film you do, you know, and I like to challenge myself to work outside my comfort zone on everything I do, whether it's on a small documentary or whether it's on one of these big mega pictures, and that's always going to be the case. You know, I think you just have to be restless, and you have to want to challenge yourself to the maximum, both creatively and technically. And I have to hit both of those quadrants for the project to be exciting enough to want to do. Because the thing is, these projects take a lot out of you, you know, both in terms of time away from the family, just, you know, kind of wear and tear. And so they have to be worth it. And to me, they have to be worth it on every level. For me, challenging is, it might be challenging in terms of some dramatic point that I'm trying to make, or something that I'm trying to get to with the actors, some moment, the creation of an emotion. And, you know, one of our biggest challenges in Avatar was to create these powerful emotional moments with CG characters.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that all sort of distills back to what the actors created. You know, that was the biggest challenge of the movie, was keeping that emotionality and keeping the process transparent enough that what the actors created was what the characters did, you know, at the end of the day.
Well, your entire career, it's been one incredible accomplishment after another. Can you get kind of turned on by smaller projects, by something that doesn't present those kind of
Probably
obstacles?
Not. I mean, I'm a little different than a lot of filmmakers who vary kind of the, you know, there's a lot of filmmakers that sort of have this idea that there's what I do for the paycheck, and maybe I'll find ways to enjoy it, but it's not really it's not my passion project. And then I'll do some little project in between to kind of assuage that urge to be completely free of studio constraints. And then I'll go back and do another big one just to, you know, reestablish myself commercially or whatever. And they oscillate back and forth. I'm not interested in that at all. The way it works for me is I'm either making a big, challenging movie, or I'm doing something else. And the something else might be a documentary, it might be ocean exploration, it might be a space project, like literally, I work on space technology projects. Or, you know, going forward, it's going to be working on environment, you know, global warming and renewable energy issues. So those take the place of, you know, those kind of little little art movies or little, you know, independent films that some filmmakers feel the need to keep in their diet. I figure what I do best is make big, technically challenging movies, and I love it, and, you know, that's what I, you know, I'm going to continue to do, or I'm going to be completely outside of the Hollywood system doing something else.
Well, believe me, we love it, too. we're not complaining. Before I let you go, I just wanted to ask you about future projects. I know that you've spoken about the Avatar 2 and 3 and your possible film about Hiroshima. Do you have timelines set for yourself on any of these projects?
It's all in flux right now. I mean, I've got to be very careful about how I pick my battles and the order in which I fight them, you know, because it's not like I'm 25 years old. And, you know, there was a time when I figured, I'll get to that one in 15 years. And, you know, after a while, 15 years gets there, and then you make that movie. But, you know, I don't see myself running at quite the speed I run right now, you know, when I'm in my 80s. So I got to pick my battles, and I haven't mapped out. You know, we're talking about big projects that take multiple years, and especially if I'm going to do two of them back to back, I've got to figure out, you know, the exact timetable. So I haven't announced anything yet, and I don't expect to for probably, you know, 6 months at a minimum.
Do you
expect?
You know,
I mean, everything that you heard about is still in play, and even a couple that you haven't heard about yet.
Do you expect the Avatar 2 underwater element to be as grueling as your experience on the Abyss? I mean, I don't know how it differs.
Probably not, because it'll be CG. I mean, we'll probably have to figure out a way to do performance capture underwater, which will make it it'll be a little wrinkle that we haven't had to deal with before. But, you know, a lot of the underwater stuff can be done without actually being underwater. It can be done, you know, dry for wet, which is how we did it on Avatar.
I'll let you go. I know your schedule's tight today, but thank you so much. We love your work, and can't thank you enough for being on the show with us.
All right, guys. Well, I appreciate your enthusiasm, and thanks for the good questions.
Can I say something about Abel? Abel was the only filmmaker. I've made it, you know, every year I go to the New York Film Festival. I'm hoping every year for this show, and I'm making a point every year to at least meet and shake hands with at least one filmmaker that I love. And so I did do that with Abel Ferrara this year. I was like, I can't leave without shaking hands with Abel Ferrara, because he's so terrific. And what a unique presence in American filmmaking.
And he's still at it. This latest movie is called 444, Last Day on Earth, Willem Dafoe. The last hours that you have on Earth, how you choose to spend those hours, you know, what kind of has any meaning at that point. And it opens in limited release on the 23rd of this month. That's this coming Friday. And so we had about 10 minutes with Abel. We talked to him about the film and about his outlook on, you know, independent film and the meaning of film in general, and here he is.
We're talking a lot how to deal with these final minutes, and today it doesn't matter where you live or how much money you have, we are all about to face the same fate at the same moment.
The Pope is at the Vatican preparing to deliver a final blessing.
At 4:44 a.m. tomorrow morning, there will be no survivors. The world will end.
They're right.
I know they're right.
What if they're wrong?
I mean, the streets look like any normal holiday. Pretty calm, at least for now.
Oh! Oh! Leave that man alone!
I'm gonna smoke my cigarette, and I'm gonna die.
A sense of caring one another, a sense of sharing one another, is a sense of community.
It's getting heavier.
We're all gonna die, guys. We're already dead.
What is wrong with you?
The end of the world, the end of the dream. I want to see it.
My heart attends your heart.
Forgive me.
We have it right now. All we have is each other.
return to New York. You haven't made a film here in a while, right?
Well, you know, we did Mulberry Street. I did Chelsea on the Rocks. You know, we're shooting for the internet, so it doesn't feel like, you know, we shot the scenes in New York here. I mean, Mary in New York. So, but yeah, you know, for a full blown feature and having it come out in New York theater and all that, I guess it's been a while.
What about New York? That environment made it particularly perfect for this material.
About 444.
Mm-hmm.
Well, New York is perfect for any material. I mean, you know, obviously if it's a film about, you know, creatures in a desert, I don't know that, but otherwise, New York is a pretty fertile environment for any kind of movie.
And the performances in your films, too, I mean, there's a lot of bravery kind of called upon for the actors in a lot of your films, and I would imagine that would be a major consideration. You want actors that are kind of fearless that way, and Willem Dafoe certainly fits the bill there.
Willem, yeah, definitely. You know, I mean, he's used to working without a net, and he kind of knows that's where, you know, that's where the ones that count come from. You know, it's a matter of not being afraid to fail. Or having the confidence that you're not going to fail. You know, that gives you that look, or, you know, gives you the movie you're talking about. You know, a film that has that kind of emotional fire to it.
Well, when you talk to actors, a lot of times they say that they want to, in order to get to that point, that trusting point, they want an environment where they feel safe enough to fail. So what as a director do you do to facilitate that for them?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, for director, you have to do everything. You know, you really have to be, you know, run interference. I mean, it's your job to, you know, I mean, everything is being channeled. The whole film is being channeled through the actor. I mean, from the story, you know, I mean, what you see mostly in film, but a character, you know, it has to be channeled through him. And it's funny, you know, he represents all the, you know, from the designer to the editor to the writer to the musician to me, the director, you know what I mean? It's all put into him, and you want him out there with the trust and the confidence and you know, that he could make his moves, that he could do what he does, what Willem does, and, you know, Shannon did it too with him, you know, to find and create something, that special thing.
Well, yeah,
and my opinion, I know, I wish I could be more specific, but
No, that's fine. That's great. But particularly in this film, I mean, there's kind of a level of intimacy between Willem and Shannon, and I would think that would translate into the environment on the set.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. You know, I mean, that's where it is. That's where it happens on the set. And that, you know, more people have to realize that every single human being who's there, whether he's the third PA or whatever, his feeling and his emotions are captured by that camera or reflected off the performer himself, you know. You know what I mean? And that's why, you know, so much of the job is just to allow him to do his thing, you know.
Do you feel like, because, I mean, this film deals with the last hours that we have on Earth and how we choose to occupy those hours, but a lot of critics have mentioned that it's oddly life affirming, and I'm curious
considering we kill everybody on the planet.
Well, yeah, there's a level of grace to it, and I'm curious, do you think that this would be a different movie? The tone would be different if you made it as a younger man.
Well, I don't know if I would have been concerned with the issues if I was a younger man, you know. I don't know if this would have, I would have brought the passion as needed to, you know, do it if I wasn't who and what I am at this age, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do you feel like your passion for cinema has changed at all since you started? I mean, the business around it has changed, I'm sure, but your drive to do it, has that changed at all?
No, I don't think it has, really. I mean, although, you know, maybe you look back at your young years with the rose-colored glasses, but I don't think I've changed all that much in terms of what I'm expecting and what I want from the process, mm-hmm. from making movies, you know.
And what do you think the power of movies are? Because in this movie, your two lead characters, they're both artists. And so I'm curious, you know, when everything does come to an end, what role do you think that art and film plays in enriching the life experience?
That's a tough one, man. That's a tough question, dude. That's a tough question. You have to ask that again. The word is different because that's...
I'm sorry.
That's a beautiful question. And that was a beautiful question.
You chose to make your two lead characters artists. So
right.
How do you think art enriches the life experience, especially, you know, when you know that everything's going to end? I mean, how does something... What matters in the end, you know?
What matters is the relationship between these two people, that the two there, you know, that they're both in love. For her, she's a Buddhist, so life goes on. It's not an ending, it's just a beginning. You know, I think he's at the point where he knows that he doesn't know, and he's willing to follow her out into the world that, you know, of the afterlife.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a phenomenal movie, and I was told I have only 10 minutes with you, and our 10 minutes is up. So,
are you kidding me? Oh my God, it seemed like a minute. Thank you so much for the questions.
Thank
all
you
right?
so much, sir. Thank you for your prayer.
Right, love you. Same here. All right, thanks.
We're very excited tonight to welcome director John Sayles to the show. He is a tremendous filmmaker whose stellar and versatile works include films like 8 Men Out, The Return of the Secaucus 7, Baby It's You, The Brother from Another Planet, City of Hope, Passion Fish, and Silver City. Each of his films are elevated by his profoundly independent spirit and his refusal to compromise his vision to satisfy typical Hollywood conventions. Now in his 16th gorgeously realized vision titled Honey Dripper, he tells the story of an aging juke joint owner in 1950s Alabama who has one last shot to save his beloved establishment and his fragile independence. Starring Danny Glover, Stacey Keach, and Charles Dutton, Honey Dripper is a fantastically entertaining and rich experience, possessing the keen understanding of character and place that mark all of Mr. Sayles' astonishing work. It is a great honor to welcome to our program Mr. John Sayles. Mr. Sayles, are you with us?
I'm with you. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, you forgot to mention that I was in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest on stage.
That's right.
Yeah, I specialized for a long time in very large, very mentally challenged people. I played Chief Bromden and Lenny and Of Mice and Men and people like that.
And the Glass Menagerie, didn't you do a run
Yeah,
of that?
I was the son in the Glass Menagerie. Eventually, John Malkovich, who I just met about a month ago, was in the movie version of that theater production
sure.
with Joanne Woodward.
And talk about the great American play. I mean, the Glass Menagerie is it for me.
Yeah,
at least.
Yeah. And to get to do it with Joanne Woodward was just terrific.
So tell me about, since we've opened up the conversation here, I know that you act in some of your own films,
mm-hmm.
some films of others. What does that give you? Why is that important to you to do that?
Well, you know, in my own films, it's sometimes a way not to have to pay for the airline ticket to bring another actor in, which saves us a lot of money. In Honey Dripper, quite honestly, once again being large. Danny Glover's about 6'3", I'm 6'4", and my character's on screen very short period of time, and so he needs to be a little bit intimidating. So it helps to be, you know, there's not that many guys in American movies bigger than Danny. So that helps. And I played a lot of cop number one in movies.
Sure. Yeah, but your movies are known for, among other things, their tremendous performances.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think it's a way to keep yourself empathetic to the experience of the actor.
Yeah, you know, I think it actually helps my writing even more than my directing. You know, the thing that a good actor does when he gets a part is first think about how does this person see the world?
Right.
You know, how when they walk into a room, you know, how do they interpret things?
Right.
And that's what you do when you write characters. A lot of the drama is not just that they want different things, but they actually see a different world when they walk into that room. You know, they're not even, you know, barely speaking the same language. And so, you know, it's one of the reasons the characters in my movie, you know, they sound different. You know, they don't talk the same. They don't see the world the same. And, you know, that experience, and I'm usually a day player, so you also get the great experience of coming onto a movie set and people are auditioning for you without knowing it, because, you know, a day player, you know, the minute you say your last line, you're like furniture and nobody pays any more attention to you. You know, you just try to get out of the way really quickly. So nobody's really paying that much attention to you except, you know, let's hope this guy doesn't blow his lines and make us go into overtime. But you get to see technicians, I've worked with cinematographers, actors, you know, all kinds of crew people who I observed first by being in somebody else's movie.
Sure, sure. Let's talk about your writing for a little bit, because, you know, among other things, you're known for doing script work for the big studios.
Mm-hmm.
You get handed a lot of high-profile projects from the studios, and whether it's a complete rewrite or just an original draft that you work on for them. But is there a sense, because you don't know how much of your fingerprints will be on the final product, is there a sense of disengagement in that?
You know, I wouldn't call it disengagement. I would say you're just kind of like a carpenter. You know, you're not the architect, really. You're there to help them tell their story. Mm-hmm. And so, like, a good carpenter, you might say, well, you know, if you put the windows over there, you're not going to get any light in the morning. But if they say, but that's where we want the windows, you do your best job to put the windows there.
Sure.
So you can't get, I certainly work harder when I work for a studio or for somebody else trying to help them. You know, I do more drafts. I have to think harder. I'm trying to make it something I would want to go see, but also that solves, you know, their problems, the first of which being they can get a green light when they hand it upstairs. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the first hurdle that they have to go back, you know, past. But, you know, you just can't get that emotionally involved, because at some point they may just say, oh, we just got such and such an actor. You know, that 45-year-old woman, she's now 20.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I once sat in a meeting with John Frankenheimer, and I had about 3 or 4 days to write this script, because there was about to be a screenwriter's strike, which I'm on strike right now as we speak. He said, oh, by the way, you know, all the Chinese people in this story, make them Japanese. I can get Toshirô Mifune. And I said, you know, well, the martial arts and the cultures are very different. He said, yeah, but I can get Toshirô Mifune. Now, if that was my picture and a studio said, we'll finance it if you make them all Japanese, I would have said, no, I'm sorry, they're Chinese. But, you know, luckily I knew something about Japanese culture and martial arts, and I thought, Toshirô Mifune is a great idea. You know, this is before Jet Li was around. You know, if it was today, I would have said, get Jet Li and we can keep him Chinese. But,
sure.
You know, so I did a very, very quick, 4-day rewrite, and they ended up making the movie.
Do you ever come across a project, Cold Case? That was one of the last ones that you worked on. Do you ever come across a good quality project like that that you have an itch to maybe try out on your own? Does that ever happen?
You know, sometimes it does, but it's not like they're going to just give it to me and say, cast it how you want to and cut it how you want to. You know, generally when you're working for those companies, they're in such a high-stakes poker game that they're going to try to control every aspect of it so that they have a better chance of making a lot of money. So, you know, the casting is not necessarily who's the best actor for this or even who's the best known actor for this. It's kind of, well, who could kind of be acceptable as that character who's really hot right now?
Yeah,
and that can change from the time that you write it. You know, so at the last minute, they may just say, oh, no, we want this actor, who may not be really who you think would be good at it, but they're really hot at that moment. So that usually tempers my temptation. Plus, they're not offering it to me anyway. You know? So, you know, it's not a good idea to get your hopes up against, you know, something that you know is not going to happen.
Sure. You talk about casting, and, you know, I see in Honey Dripper, I see Danny Glover and Charles Dutton together, and it just makes so much sense. Why hasn't this happened before?
Mm-hmm.
And in your own films, when you sit down to write them, do you write with particular actors in mind, or is that...
You know, I try not to, because, you know, you don't want to start out the process being disappointed and write something specifically for one person, and then they say no, and then they say, well, what happens to my character? I mean, I used to have this problem when I wrote, you know, before I started directing, they, you know, the studio would say, well, who do you see as this character? And I'd always say Spencer Tracy, you know, and there just wasn't a Spencer Tracy around in those days, and you know, there still isn't.
Did they ask you who Spencer Tracy was?
Not yet. In those days, no. They
okay,
still know.
Good.
Today
okay.
They would, you know. You know, so what I do is I try to write it, and then I read it over a couple times. In the case of Honey Dripper, the first time I read it, I said, Danny Glover. You know, he solves 99 of my percent of my problems if I could get Danny Glover to do this. And luckily, he said yes right away. And so the next round of asking people to come and work for scale, we were able to say, well, here's the movie, here's a good part, it's only 5 weeks of shooting, and Danny Glover's the lead. And that gets you past the agent, at least, you know.
Yeah.
And then the actor can say yes or no on their own. But, you know, there's been movies where we couldn't even get past the agent.
On that first draft, like the first draft of Honey Dripper, do you write with budgetary concerns in mind, or do you leave that kind of consideration for your rewrites?
I try not to think about that stuff until the last draft. And the last draft that I do is usually after we've gone to the location, we've shown it to some local people who know more about, you know, how cotton gets picked or this or that or the other. So some of what goes into that last draft is local knowledge, as they say. But also, you know, I've gotten to talk with the first AD and the production manager and Maggie Renzi, who produces it, and they can come back to me and say, okay, here's an eighth of a page, and it's also an eighth of our budget. You know, is this that important, this shot? This is what this is costing. Or, and sometimes the answer is yes, it is worth it. Other times it's, well, does, you know, this have to be at night? Night shooting is more expensive than day. Or, you know, here's an actor who we have to pay for 6 days when he's not working because he says yup in another scene. Could you give that line to somebody else or have him just nod his head and then, you know, or eliminate him from that scene or whatever? So, you know, it's a very practical draft, that last draft. When I sit down to write a script, I do, though, have an idea of, okay, is this one that we could, you know, make fairly easily, or I could possibly finance myself, or is this just one of those dream projects that, like 8 Men Out, took 11 years from the point where I wrote the first draft until we got to make it?
Yeah, what a journey. With Honey Dripper, what were the first germs of the idea that struck you, and what did you wind up wanting to explore with that piece?
You know, I think the real seed of it came from, you know, my kind of long relationship with American music. I think, like most people, you grow up, you turn on the radio, and there's the music, and you like it or you don't like it, but you just kind of accept that there it is. And then as I got older, I started hearing little things that weren't, you know, top 40 rock and roll, or little traces of things. And so in my case, Sam Cooke led me to the blues and gospel, along with Ray Charles. And that automatically leads you into the past. And I was born in 1950, and I started realizing, oh, this music came from somewhere. You know, there's a lot of ingredients that went into this thing that we call rock and roll, and it wasn't always called rock and roll. And then as I got even older, I started to realize, oh, the electric guitar wasn't always around. What did that do? And so a lot of what Honey Dripper deals with is one of those kind of big watershed transformations. You know, it happened in Hollywood when the silent movies gave way to the talkies.
Mm-hmm.
And within 2 years, there were people who were just out of work, who couldn't make that transition, or in some cases, there were directors who just said, well, that's not an art. I do silent movies, you know. And there were people who struggled with it, you know, Charlie Chaplin. You know, it took him quite a while to to make his first talkie movie and really feel comfortable with it. So what happened in the music world when, you know, I think the players can sense these things quicker than the audience can. They saw that solid body electric guitar with the amplifier that came with it for the first time. An awful lot of them must have said, uh-oh, everything's going to change. And I either get on this thing that's leaving the station or I get left behind.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a beautiful movie, and but music plays no small part in a lot of your films. And tell me how important music is in kind of fueling and inspiring your creative process.
You know, it comes in a bunch of different ways. Sometimes very literally, because I often write these epics that, you know, how am I ever going to get this thing financed when I'm not really working with a studio and it's so hard to raise money for everybody. There's a couple songs that I know are going to be in the movie, and I just put them on, and that just kind of gets you back into the fight. You know, Hazel Dickens singing some of the songs that showed up later in Mate Juan. You know, that took 7 years from the time that I wrote the first draft until we got to make it. And every once in a while, it just looked, you know, we had literally, we were leaving on the airplane the next day to go to West Virginia to set up our office. And the people who said they were financing it called and said, oh, they didn't approve our bank loan. We're not financing the movie. And we were just left flat, you know. Yeah. So there were a couple of years there where we didn't do anything. And, you know, I just stick on Hazel singing a couple of these songs and say, this is worth doing. You know, that one song so encapsulated what I wanted the feeling of the movie to be that it, you know, kind of got our blood rushing again. Whenever I finish a script, I send it to Mason Daring, who's the composer I've worked with, on 15 of the 16 movies. Actually, the other Baby It's You, we didn't have any composed music, and I worked with Joel Dorn, who recently passed, who helped us with the music clearances. And, you know, we start talking about what's going to be the music voice of the movie. You know, I think I'm going to buy some songs, I send those back and forth. You don't always get the ones you want, so you have to have some alternates. We start talking about the menu of instruments, what the voice of the movie is going to be. In the case of Mate Juan, we listen to an awful lot of that kind of West Virginia, Kentucky, you know, hill music, and we decided, okay, everything in this music except for the banjo. You know, this just is not a banjo story, and also because the banjo, after Bonnie and Clyde, had gotten, you know, kind of used for car commercials and, you know, hillbilly comedies and stuff like that. And it just didn't fit the palette of that movie anymore.
Yeah.
So it's part of the, you know, the tone of the movie that you have to start with right away. In the case of Honey Dripper, we also had to, you know, almost all the music you hear in the film that's performed is performed live in the film. You know, I didn't want, just as, you know, in Limbo, I didn't want Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio to have to lip sync to herself, so she's singing live. I wanted, you know, Gary Clark Jr. and Eddie Shaw and all our great players, when they do a solo, they're really doing a solo. And every take of it is slightly different. You know, so we pre-recorded the drum so that we'd always be on the same beat. But other than that, we just did a very careful, you know, live recording of it, so we could separate instruments later. And if you cut to the saxophone, we could raise the saxophone without raising any of the other instruments.
Yeah, and it does have that electric feel like live music does, and music really does create a instant world feeling of the environment that you're in, and that's what your movies are probably best known for, the sense of community and location. And I know that you shot this in Alabama, but where does that come from? I think I read where you hitchhiked across the U.S. when you were a teenager. Where does that awareness of,
you know, I think it really does come from being in different places and realizing part of what I'm getting here and part of what I'm feeling here and part of who these people are here is the place itself. And sometimes it's just a physical thing, you know, that is, you know, Mate Juan is in the hills and hollers of West Virginia, there's no escape. Everywhere you turn, there's a big mountain face, you know, right by you. Whereas in Lone Star, it's a widescreen movie, partly because there's this endless horizon, and it gives you just a different feeling. You know, in Limbo, you're in Alaska, and you walk out your door, and you realize nature is big and I am small, you know, which doesn't happen in a lot of other places.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes it's just a physical thing, but also a culture, you know, and culture is a lot of who we are and a lot of, as I said before, how we see the world is about a time and a place. So, you know, Harmony, Alabama in 1950, where Honey Dripper is set, is different than the towns that we shot in to make the movie. You know, we shot in Greenville, in Anniston, where the Army base is. We shot in a town called Georgiana, which is the town that you see in the movie that has just railroad tracks in the center of the town. That's where Hank Williams grew up.
Mm-hmm.
That place existed in a time and place and was like nowhere else. And the things that people assume, you know, for instance, there's a little scene in the film where it's just a throwaway, but, you know, the people go to the back door of the hardware store and they pass the colored only entrance sign. Well, that was an assumption in most of those places. They usually didn't even have to have the sign because there weren't that many strangers who came into those little cotton towns. Everybody just knew. You're on this side of the street or that side of the street. You're on this side of the tracks or that side of the tracks. And if you're African American, you don't go to the front entrance.
Mm-hmm. What really impressed me about this movie too, particularly Danny Glover's performance, is you feel so much history in that character, and yet it isn't explicitly expressed. But I understand that you write character bios for each of your actors prior to shooting.
Yeah, you know, even if it's a small part, if it's a, you know, if it's a one-page part, you might get a half-a-page bio. Danny got something that was 7 or 8 pages long, and a lot of it, you know, and I included a CD, so he got the double set. a lot of it was his musical history. You know, he's playing a boogie-woogie piano player, and you figure he's 50-something in 1950. He grew up with the music. You know, his life is the first half of the 20th century in American music. So when he's a little boy, they're starting to play the blues. And the blues really didn't exist for very long before 1900. And then he was in New Orleans when Buddy Bolden and King Oliver were playing. And then, you know, he was around during the Ma Rainey, you know, kind of Bessie Smith thing when that stuff started getting on the radio and they started recording people, and he was with swing bands. And now he's playing basically jump music and boogie-woogie and old blues.
Uh-huh.
And there's this new thing that shows up. And so a lot of what Danny needed to know is, what kind of piano player am I? Even to the point where, you know, Danny doesn't actually play in the movie, but the piano player we got to play the stuff, we made sure that he knew, oh, this guy has spent a lot of time in New Orleans because there's a style of piano playing that comes out of New Orleans that's different than anywhere else in the world. So that's a lot of what you want your actor to know, and it's not always in the script itself. So you want to give them that stuff that they can ammunition because they're going to do their own work as well, but you want to get them started down the right track, and that's why I write those bios.
Yeah, I was wondering how much of it's a tremendous gift for an actor, I would think, but how much of a collaboration working up that backstory would be, because they have to have their own ideas.
You know what, I try to head them off, you know, because actors like nature abhor a vacuum, and what you find is if you don't give them something, they'll come with something of their own, and it may actually get them off the track. You know, all of a sudden,
sure.
It's, well, I can't do that because my uncle beat me with a wire coat hanger when I was 3 years old. And he said, what? You know, but if you give them something, and that's the conversation you've had. One of the things is, this is a very ambitious movie, Honey Dripper. We only had 5 weeks to shoot it.
Uh-huh.
We can't really have those deep philosophical actor, director, who am I questions on the set. I got to have those beforehand, and we do it in correspondence and over the phone, and then really on the set, it's about the blocking of the scene, and then really what you want to do is turn those good actors loose on each other. And so the collaboration, to a certain extent, has already happened by the time we get to the set. And then the next part of the collaboration is the actors with each other. We have so many good actors in this. You know, there's a there's a great little scene between Lisa Gay Hamilton and Mary Steenburgen. And, you know, it's like a small play. And we had one day to shoot it. And they just, you know, Mary, we only had her for one day, and she just hooked into this other actor. And they're supposed to be people who have known each other for years and years and years and years and have this strange employer-employee, black and white, 1950 Alabama relationship. And they just knocked me out. Now, that doesn't mean I didn't do any directing, but a lot of my directing was, you're going in this direction, push it in this way a little bit more, or hold back a little bit more before you show that, or try to hide this from her, or whatever.
Yeah.
And then a lot of it is just the louder, softer, move a little to your right, move a little to your left stuff.
When you have great actors like that, I would think that a big discipline would be knowing when not to direct.
Exactly. I mean, truly the first couple takes, and we don't do that many takes, is just to see what they're going to do.
Yeah.
What are they going to bring? Because, you know, quite honestly, I try to just cast good actors to do something I have never seen them do before. You know, maybe I've seen a hint of it, but never on that scale or that size of a part. Or, you know, David Strathairn, who I've worked with, you know, 6 or 7 times. It's just, David, do something cool, you know. And each time it's a very different character, and it's always just fun to see who is he this time.
And you know,
what are they going to throw at us? Yeah.
Yeah. Why hasn't it gotten easier for you to fund these movies? You obviously attract a tremendous caliber of actor.
You know, well, that's the one thing that has gotten easier, and it's the biggest compliment we get is you know, the actors who say yes to basically working for scale and, you know, working hard and being in a movie that's not going to get, you know, $20 to $30 million of national advertising thrown behind it. What's gotten harder, I think, is just that unless your movies, no matter who you are, whether you're working in a studio system or outside of it, if your last couple movies didn't go platinum, the people who put money into movies are not, you know, they just don't see the upside.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're just not going to be on the hot list for that long, and we never quite made it. Also, and this is, once again, a very mixed thing, there's a lot more competition than there used to be.
Yeah.
When we started, our first movie came, we made it in 78, and it opened in 1980. You know, there were maybe 12 to 15 independent movies made, and the heads of the 3 or 4 companies that distributed those movies, the heads of the company would look at anything with sprocket holes. Now, there's 15 people under the heads of those maybe 20 companies that do that, and it's got to go up through a chain of people before that head of the company even says yes and watches 10 minutes of it on his DVD while he's making phone calls. And, you know, the Sundance Film Festival is getting 5,000 or 6,000 features submitted every year. And some of those people, 3 years later, make a second film. And so, you know, the amount of competition, there's still only 52 weeks in the year. There's still X number of theaters that show non-Hollywood movies. So, you know, a non-Hollywood screen could show a different movie every week and have a pretty good movie, a watchable movie.
Yeah.
You know, and you just can't make money back to make your next film if it only plays for 1 week. So that's the difficulty that we're in. And you know, we're distributing Honey Dripper partly to find a way around that. And I think that, you know, the movie business, certainly the independent movie business, has got to start doing what the music business did, which is to find other avenues of attack, because the old system isn't working for people.
Yeah. So, but you did open this past weekend in New York and LA, was it? And
yeah.
What's the plan from here?
Well, we're going to try to hold those theaters in those big cities, and then pretty much start in Martin Luther King Day and the very end of January, we're going to start opening other cities. We'll never have that many prints at first, but we'll go to Atlanta, do an opening there. We're going to, you know, actually, we're going to be in the next 2 months in 17 different cities.
Wow.
You know, doing it the kind of legwork way, getting a little buzz going personally. We're doing a lot more stuff on the web than we used to, which is nice because it's direct and it doesn't cost as much as buying an ad. And because, you know, quite honestly, you can, you know, what they used to call narrowcast a lot more. So we've been doing a lot more interviews with music magazines, with, you know, modern guitar magazine, all that, because of the music component of it. You know, and just let's make every shot count instead of just, you know, spraying the whole neighborhood with a machine gun.
Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited, YouTube at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited, or bookmark our website at moviegeeksunited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited.